You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name's Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking with Ben Yahtzee Croshaw, a curveball guest. I'm very excited to speak to him. Not only is he not a stand-up comedian, but he is also not really a performer. In fact, if anything, he's closer to a reviewer. But he's not a comedy critic, he's a reviewer of video games, and for the last 12 years has produced over 700 videos entitled Zero Punctuation, and lots of other content besides, not to mention having written a few books as well. We're going to talk about all of those things and really get under the skin of what drives Ben, and we hear some fascinating revelations about exactly why his video series, which is very scabrous and funny and scathing criticism of video games, we're going to find out exactly why it is created in the manner in which he creates it. So without further ado, this is Ben Yahtzee Croshaw. Let's begin there, because I know we have Portal 2 in common as a favourite video game. So even though you have... Is that your favourite still? I believe that's the case. Or a positively reviewed one? Portal 2.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favourites.
Oh, my God. It's wonderful. Just wonderful. A door that shoots guns. It's just... I'm so excited about the concept. A gun that shoots doors.
Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, that's Portal 3. Are you not up to date? So let's begin then with before we get into you trying stand-up comedy, which will be part 1A. Just for the benefit of listeners to the show who are not familiar with your stuff, basically anyone that's never heard of the internet, could you tell us exactly what it is that you do and are most known for?
I do a weekly internet series called Zero Punctuation, in which I review a recent video game, or a video game I feel like talking about, if there aren't any recent ones worth talking about. And I've been doing that for about 12 years.
I mean, that's an incredibly long time in internet time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's paying the bills, I ain't complaining.
And who was doing online videos regularly when you started? Who were kind of your peers? Does it work like that in the internet?
Well, people who were doing that sort of thing at the time were people like the angry video game nerd.
Okay, I've never heard of such a person.
Yeah, he was one of the early ones who hit upon the formula of like pretending to be really angry at video games in front of a camera.
Okay.
But I think I was more influenced by, I think, written internet comedy. And I still like very tightly script most of my stuff. I wonder what I'm doing on this podcast, because I consider myself more of a comedy writer, I suppose.
Yes. Well, that's, it's a broad church. It's an increasingly broad church, the podcast. So let's talk about your influences then. I mean, I suppose the person that you would wear on your sleeve most would be someone like Charlie Brooker.
Yes, I had a feeling we'd come to that. Because I was a fan of his, long before he was on TV, because he used to write for PC Zone magazine back in the 90s.
You see, I think of myself as one of the cool kids because I know him from TV Go Home. but you predate even that.
Yeah, when I was really young... I think reading video game magazines was sort of an introduction to what I do now, because back in the day, especially when I was a kid in the 90s, there was very often this weird sort of punk humor running through video game journalism. And PC Zone was a big part of that when Charlie Brooker was writing for it. I think that was where I started gaining an appreciation for the negative review as a comedy source.
Yes, and he, and I'm afraid I've just, you mentioning, not PC Zone, I was never into PC Zone, but I have just remembered the existence of Kamikaze Bear from, I don't know if that is too dated a reference even for you, that was from your Sinclair or Sinclair User magazine, possibly.
Right, I had a Commodore 64, so I read Commodore format.
Oh, you were one of them. God, yeah. Nothing to do with you. Fine, fair enough. That's an early allusion to the two very separate terms.
I had a question for you related to video game journalism.
Oh, sure.
We'll see how obscure this goes, but do you remember do you remember Digitizer?
Oh, I don't know that I do. No, I'm sorry.
All right, I'll take that back a step. Do you remember Teletext?
Yes, very much so, of course.
Digitizer was like a video game magazine on Channel 4's Teletext pages.
I do remember it.
You do remember that?
Yeah, yes, I do, yeah.
Because that was one of, again, sort of like PC Zone, it was a video game journalism, but it had this weird, very characteristic, anarchic, a very characteristically British, anarchic, surreal, and slightly dark humour running through it.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
It feels like an era. It feels of a piece with things like 2000 AD, comics.
Yes.
And Warhammer 40,000, you know, that kind of Games Workshop, sorts of people that write the text for... God, this stuff coming... I mean, this is all things I've not thought about for 30 years, but, you know, Warg the Orcs.
Yeah.
And that sort of mentality. There's a particularly... it is peculiar to Britain, I suppose. And do you feel that you're kind of that territory? Was that you were kind of moulded in that?
I feel I'm born partly out of it. I'm certainly influenced by it. I mean, I think being foreign sort of gives you an advantage in our line of work.
Yes. Yes, certainly. Yes. I certainly have found that going to comedy festivals in, for example, New Zealand, where suddenly I, a middle-class white British man, am special.
Yeah. So that's one of the ways to get noticed on the internet, certainly, and have a weird accent.
Yes. So were the viewers of Zero Punctuation predominantly American?
I think so. I mean, in as much as I think most of the viewers on the internet at the time would have been predominantly American.
Oh, of course, they sort of had it first, didn't they?
Yeah,
fair. So just to go back to who you were before you started creating Zero Punctuation, which now is, I mean, a phenomenally long-running... You've done nearly 500 episodes, I think, or is that way past that now?
Yeah, it's like over 700 now.
Oh, good Lord. I've been gleaning information about you, not just from the videos and other, you know, Wikipedia things, but also from comments on videos, which you then suddenly realise are several years out of date.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's the trouble with the internet. I mean, yeah, the difference between what I do and comedy is that comedy, like stand-up comedy, is very iterative, I understand.
Yes.
You have to, like, work with an audience to get instant feedback and, like, alter your material as you're delivering it. But what I do is just put it out there, and then it's like that forever.
Yeah.
And people find that, like, 10 years down the line. They find videos where you've made, a crass mistake. Where your voice sounded a bit weird, or you weren't quite bringing your A game, and someone watches that today and thinks that's just what you like in a permanent basis.
Well, this is already fascinating to me in terms of being a creator of things that stay there and have stayed there for 12 years.
Yeah.
Talk us through. I don't know where to start. Let's start with who you were as a kid in this culture in Britain. Whereabouts in Britain? You were in Rugby, were you?
Yeah, I was born in Rugby in Warwickshire.
That's ridiculous. I'm from Leamington.
Oh, really?
So yeah. I remember seeing that and going, oh yeah, okay. We've probably, I don't know. I don't know how old you are. Maybe we were sneered at by the same people in the street.
It's possible. I think. I looked you up actually in preparation for this.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and you are older. I was born in 83.
Okay. I was born in showbiz. Anyway, so what kind of a kid were you at school? I feel like I can imagine your school days purely on the basis of the fact that you're an internet guy that writes about video games. How much of what you think is perceived about you is actually the case?
Well, are you picturing an incredibly awkward young man?
I'm letting you picture that.
Yeah, I was awkward. I wasn't I wasn't one of the sporty lads.
Sure.
I think in high school, I spent most of my lunch times in the school library and then the school computer room when they let us. Yeah, so video games were part of it right from the beginning.
And did you have lots of friends? Did you have one or two close friends? No friends?
I had one or two close friends, none of whom I'm still in contact with.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't a social animal. I think towards the end of high school, I started taking on a bit of a class clown sort of attitude.
Okay. Talk to me about that, because that's something that I associate far more readily with stand-up comedians, being either the funny kid in the class or more likely the jealous kid looking at the second funniest kid, looking at the funny kid and thinking it should be me. What sorts of successes did you have socially with humour?
I don't know, just when we were in class and everyone was like expected to sit around being bored, I just started getting a kick out of like saying things or doing things that would make the rest of the room laugh, even if they were just laughing at me.
Because I mean it's easy to imagine you were sort of adopting a status position and kind of ripping the teachers or something like that. Was it that sort of thing?
No, I was very deferent to the teachers. I think. I mean, I was trying to I tried to say things to make them laugh, and they probably thought I was a complete twat.
A frightful tick or something British, something Warwickian. Okay.
I think part of it is that I do have like problems with anxiety still. So
okay.
I think a lot of it is like what I do is out of wanting to be accepted, just to like pop psychology myself.
Sure. Well, I was about to pop psychology you, so I'm very glad that you've opened that up yourself. It's very much a preconception of this this podcast, I suppose.
Well, I was putting stuff online for years before I started doing zero punctuation. While I still lived in England, I was like maintaining a blog. I tried doing webcomics for a while, but everything I put out for free and didn't expect to monetize, because all I was hoping was for someone to praise it, you know?
Okay. And do you think that was representative of the sorts of people that were also blogging at that time? Did you feel of a piece with other people doing something similar?
Well, I was certainly influenced by other people doing that sort of thing. I used to read a lot of like humor sites. It's funny how there's always been this sort of connection between comedy and video games in that, because there were a lot of early blogs on the internet. Like there was a site called Old Man Murray.
Okay.
And one of the writers on that went on to become one of the writers on Portal, which you brought up earlier.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, Eric Walpaw, who also did some of the writing on Psychonauts. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I don't think I have, no.
That's a well-regarded cult comedy game.
Okay.
And
I remember, when you talk about sort of cult comedy games, I remember the Spectrum version of... it was the game of... the cash-in book, How to Be a Complete Bastard. Do you remember that, starring Adrian Edmondson? And the game was very, very simple, kind of scrolling 2D, and you had to walk around at a party, ruining everything at the party. And I remember it had, in terms of like an anarchic joke, there was... you were playing it on a Spectrum 48K, and at one point in the party, if you looked in the airing cupboard, you found a Spectrum 48K with a game that was loaded, and you had an option to reset it. Which older video game players will know, that's 4 hours, 4 minutes of reloading, watching loading screens. And if you reset it, it reset your computer, the one that you were playing it on.
Yeah, you're making me nostalgic for a time when video games could be something like that. Someone could just make something stupid and put it out on like the Spectrum or the Commodore 64 and get it sold in shops.
Yes, I remember, this is all coming back to me now, I remember a free game with your Sinclair or ZX user, something like that, which was Advanced Lawnmower Simulator, where it was on a little cassette that came free on the cover, and it was just the dumbest, you know, and again, a very British sense of humour.
Yeah, there were a lot of games like that. I mean, I'm thinking of, like, there was almost a subgenre of lawnmower games. There was one called Hover Bover, I think it was called. Where you were trying to mow a lawn and a dog was trying to get in the way. This is when video games could be like something like that, when no one really cared that much about enormous mainstream appeal like video games do these days.
Yes. Well, I think we'll get onto that. I know that's a preoccupation of yours. Mm. But to stay with those, the kind of the early days for the moment, I mean, I never got past 10 print I am skill 20 go to 10. That was absolutely the extent of my programming. So what were you teaching yourself to program?
Yes.
As you were blogging?
Sort of, yeah. I was sort of teaching myself to program on the Commodore 64 when I was a kid. I'd make like stupid little games that nobody but me would ever see. I've always liked tried to mess around with like game creation tool. I've used a lot of like game creation tools because
I don't really know what they are. Does that kind of try and simplify it into a bit more of a drag and drop process?
I mean, it's like programs specifically designed by people to make specific kinds of games. And I used to use something called Adventure Game Studio that would make point and click adventure games in the style of The Secret of Monkey Island.
Okay.
That sort of thing. And those were like the first games I designed.
Okay.
So I made some of those and put them on the internet, released them for free because I just wanted praise.
And did you get any praise?
Yeah. I mean, actually, before I was got viral on Zero Punctuation, I was semi-well known as an adventure game, as like an indie adventure game designer in those circles.
Okay. What was your big success from back then?
I wrote an adventure game called 5 Days a Stranger, which was this horror, like mansion escape sort of thing.
Okay.
About like some people trapped in a mansion and a ghost is trying to kill them. That got fairly widespread, if you look that up. I mean, if you look at my Wikipedia page, a lot of it is still concerned with the video games I've put online.
And when you say that, is that because someone else wrote it? When you say a lot of it is concerned with that, is it kind of like fan updated?
Yeah, someone else wrote that. I would never write my own Wikipedia page. Christ, who does?
No,
who does that?
I absolutely haven't done that, and I think that will become that will become increasingly anachronistic as everyone. Of course, you should write your own Wikipedia page. I could not ever bring myself to do that. What sorts of things were good about that game, about 5 Days a Stranger? What were you particularly proud of? What did you feel like you'd nailed?
It's hard to say. When I look back, it kind of makes me cringe a bit because over the years, I've become less into adventure games.
Okay.
Because I'm more interested in like video games, the interactive art form, the different things you can do with that, with concepts like challenge and catharsis. And adventure games were very, very story-based. It was basically just linear stories, and you'd have to like solve basic, like key and door puzzles to progress through the story.
Yes, and so there was no real. It was an A to B story.
Yeah, but some of the like the early comedy video games were basically all adventure games because it was all like comedy dialogue.
Yes,
Secret of Monkey Island was a very funny game.
Yes, I never played the Monkey Island games. I remember playing Space Quest.
Oh yes, that's another good example.
Yeah, there were really funny gags on that. There were funny deaths.
Yeah, that was part of the appeal. Because you're talking...
Yeah.
This was like a big rivalry in the 90s of the two big adventure game developers. There was LucasArts, who made the Monkey Island games, and there was Sierra, who made Space Quest and King's Quest and Leisure Suit Larry and things like that.
Okay.
And they had like these vastly different game design philosophies. Like LucasArts just wanted to tell you a story and make you laugh and... They had this philosophy where they didn't want the player to be whacked over their head every time they make a mistake. And Sierra was about like putting a whole bunch of funny deaths into the games it's kind of a challenge, but it's also a sort of collect-a-thon. You try to, as well as finish the story, you want to find all the different funny ways to die in it.
Yes, okay, yeah. God, and I'm really put in mind of Jet Set Willy, of dying over and over again playing Jet Set Willy on the Spectrum, and then a huge Monty Python-esque foot would come down from the ceiling and squash you.
Yeah, well,
to signify the kind of death scream.
That's part of the inherent comedy of video games, I guess. But 5 Days a Stranger was weird because that wasn't really comedy, that was horror. And horror is another thing I've had an interest in over the years.
And what is it that grabs you about horror?
I'm not sure. I mean, would you agree with the statement that there's a close link between comedy and horror?
Yes, I would. It's not something... It's come up on the podcast before, only when I was talking to Andy Nyman, who created this hit West End show and now a movie called Ghost Stories. And he was talking... He kind of really turned me on to the idea that it's to do with the build-up and release of tension.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier. It's something to do with that. But my point was that... Like, video games do horror really well. So I've always, I've always thought there's a lot of rooms to explore comedy in it as well. I mean, video games do horror well because, well, you're inherently invested in it because you don't want to be killed, because that's part of the challenge. So you want to avoid, like, the scary things. But it's also, I think, playing a video game, a single-player video game, is like this fundamentally bleak experience. Because you're in this whole other world that might be full of other, like, characters in it, but you're the only thinking, feeling human being in it.
Yes.
So there's this, like, sort of inherent loneliness that some of my favourite horror video games have tapped into really well.
Yes. Now, I know you're a big fan of, is it Silent Hill 2?
Yes, that's one of my all-time favourites, horror games.
I have played that. I can't remember whether it's 1 or 2. I've got a very vivid memory of the rivulet of blood running down from the nurse's hairline.
That was Silent Hill 1, which was on
that the, was in 1, okay.
That was on the PlayStation. Silent Hill 2 was the first one on the PlayStation 2.
Okay.
And that was like Silent Hill 1 was about, like, haunted towns taken over by demons. But Silent Hill 2 was actually this really psychological story about this depressed guy who's recently lost his wife, and he comes to the town of Silent Hill, and gets drawn into this weird symbolic metaphorical odyssey into the darkness of his own soul, and it's actually really sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I suppose for me, computer games have always been something of a guilty pleasure.
Well, that's probably why so much game journalism when I was growing up had this sort of punk comedy thing going on for it, because it was automatically this sort of slightly shameful thing that the parents didn't approve of.
Right.
Makes me think of alternative comedy, like Bottom and the Young Ones and the parents.
Yes, there's definitely some sort of shared history there, isn't
there? Yeah, the parents didn't approve of it, and therefore just like doing it at all has this sort of, as I say, punk sensibility to it.
Yes, the anarchic quality, I guess, in part comes from just the joy of deliberately shouting rude words.
Well, yeah, well, that's coming back to what I do for a living.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember seeing Bottom live, actually. And
I love Bottom.
I grew
up watching stuff like that. I think that was still a big influence on me. I think people get very sniffy about what's termed lowbrow humour.
Yes.
But I think, when you see absolute masters of it doing it, you can see it for the art form that it is.
Absolutely. I'll never forget Rick Mayall on stage being alone in the flat and going, oh, what shall I do? And I think they filmed it in Cambridge, and someone in the audience obviously shouts, have a wank, like they would do every time, lays into that
happened,
for that.
Yeah, that happened in every show. It turned into a running gag.
So you were making games, you were making video games, horror games notably.
Yeah.
Were you making funny games as well?
I made a few funny games before that, but they were never as popular. I think horror, I think, strikes a nerve with video games for some reason. There's a lot of very cheaply made, easily done horror games on the internet, like independently developed ones that are just basically walking around a small environment with very low visibility, and they play scary noises, and every now and again something jumps out, and a lot of them are really cheaply made and easily made, but for a while, like, there were tons of them coming out all the time, and some of them became really popular. Part of that was YouTube appeal, actually, because some people didn't like playing them, but they liked watching people on YouTube play them and like react to camera in like funny ways.
Yes, I'm very late to the party on the enjoyment to be had from watching other people play games on YouTube. I think I heard about that becoming a thing a few years ago and really turned my nose up at it. And then for some reason, I kept getting Rust videos on YouTube, no idea why, and just watching lunatics play this incredibly anarchic post-apocalyptic game and bullying each other and trap each other. And I really, as someone now, I have two children, I have no time to play video games. I actually did see the appeal of watching someone else play it for me in a way that I could easily drop in and out.
It's really huge now. There's like whole media empires based around people playing and streaming video games. Like the video game publishers are all in bed with it now. They used to try to clamp down on it because they thought people watching it on YouTube means they wouldn't buy it for themselves.
Of course.
But then when you were a kid and you watch someone play a game, what's the first thing you do? You ask to have your go. So yes, it's actually turned into a really effective marketing strategy for video games. So they're all very much in favour of it now.
And why do you think in the early days of you creating horror and horror games being successful, there wasn't an equivalent? It's not that comedy games were particularly successful in the same way?
It's hard to say. I mean, these days it's hard to find video games that do comedy well.
Yeah.
I mean, the adventure games all did it really well, but adventure games have sort of gone out of vogue in the, like, really big money sector of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think comedy in games these days is troubled because video games are such a huge enterprise that so many people work on.
Yeah.
And I think what makes a game like Portal and Portal 2 different, because I remember hearing about how those games were made, what they did was that the writer of the funny lines, Eric Walpole, he would actually get involved in the sound engineering and the sound programming and the level design, so that when, like, his lines were being played, he could make sure they were played with the right timing.
Yes, he could affect the timing himself rather than hand it over to be minced by someone who's...
Exactly, yeah, because the sound engineer and level designer might be very good at that, but they might not necessarily be good at comic timing and that sort of thing.
Yes, you see that with certain sitcoms that, you know, an editor can absolutely make or break a show based on, you know, their decision of what take is used, their decision of when to cut away, when to go for it.
And a lot of video games these days have a problem that I like to call the Spider-Man problem, because it happens in every Spider-Man video game.
Go on.
Where they want to bring across the fact that the character is a funny character who quips and says funny dialogue lines. So what they do is they create a pool of, like, five different jokes, and they just have one randomly play every time, like, you punch someone in the middle of the combat. So within, like, an hour, you've heard the same lines like 20 times, and you basically want to kill everyone involved.
Jumping ahead quickly, I have played one of your games. I've played Hatful.
Yes, that's one of my recent ones that was like a zero punctuation tie-in game.
I properly laughed out loud at that. I wonder, does it eventually suffer from the Spider-Man problem, because there is a limited amount of things you can get the character.
Well, I think one way to avoid the Spider-Man problem is try to keep it too extremely, like, lowbrow, slapsticky, sort of impact-based comedy rather than, like, witty one-liners. Because when I think back to the moments when I've laughed in video games, I think of moments like in a game like Painkiller, which has this one weapon. It's a first-person shooter. There's this one weapon that's basically like a stake launcher that fires these huge cylinders of wood. And it just fires with a really satisfying action. And when it hits an enemy, it, like, sends them flying and it pins them to a wall and all their arms and legs fly off. And that's the sort of thing I laugh at in video games. So when I was doing Hatful, I was trying to, like, create, not so much, like, fill it with funny dialogue, although I did try to put as much funny dialogue as I could put in, but sort of make the core gameplay about sort of, like, heavy impact moments, heavy comedic impact moments.
Yes, just to describe that game for the listener, you play a little man that runs around trying to catch hats on his head as they fall towards his head.
Yeah.
Initially.
Yeah.
I didn't get past the first few levels, I have to say. Even first few is probably dignified my attempts.
I mean, it probably sounds a bit dry as you describe it like that.
Yeah.
But I was deliberately like, there's, like, very solid sort of impact noises every time you start a new level. And I go, bang, bong, go, catch the hat.
Yes, and there's some very, very funny lines, and they're big, plosive, abrupt, well-timed, consistent with the voice. We'll get onto all of this when we start properly talking about zero punctuation.
Yep.
But it really properly had me laughing out loud on a train.
Well, that's good to know. I've been working on a sequel that's kind of tied up in administration at the moment.
Okay.
So hopefully that can go out soon.
Can you tell us anything about it?
Well, it's like Hatful, but you're on a moving vehicle the whole time.
That sounds annoying.
Yeah, hopefully.
So this is Yahtzee. We're going to talk more with him in just a second. I would like to take this opportunity to encourage you to read or purchase or download his books, Mogworld, I've read, and I'm also partway through We'll Save the Galaxy for Food. It's really worth reading his stuff. He's a very, very funny writer, and also I highly recommend, if you are a fan of Zero Punctuation, if you've never heard of Zero Punctuation, get online immediately, choose any computer game you've heard of, and get stuck into his opinion of it. He's so, so funny. And that parallel track thing he does of having a very funny, written, fast-paced verbal element and this kind of audio element, and then at the same time having this amazing sort of really super simple but very, very funny, very high-speed graphic element that sort of runs in a parallel track but with often different jokes. It just bombards you, and I find it just such a comedy assault on the senses. So very, very pleased to be speaking to Yahtzee, and we will get back to the interview in just a second. Lots to do at the moment. Of course, you can go to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out my tour dates. The latest things have been released at the moment, and I'm actually speaking to you right now from Texas, from Austin, Texas, where I have returned to South by Southwest for this year's incredible tech, music, gaming, film and comedy festival. I've already got episodes in the can with the brilliant Eugene Merman and the hilarious Roy Wood Jr., and I am about an hour and a half away. You can probably hear I'm talking fast at the moment, not just because Yahtzee is a very, very fast speaker, in his videos at least, but also because I'm starting to get a bit giddy, because in about 90 minutes or so, I'm going to be interviewing the incredible Kathy Griffin about comedy, the First Amendment, and exactly what happened to her and why when in May of 2017, she tweeted a picture, a sort of promotional picture of her holding up the, not the real severed head of Donald Trump, a mask of Donald Trump covered in ketchup, which turned out to be arguably the defining moment of her career, and certainly set in place a number of huge changes in the way she works, and indeed the way in which she was allowed or not to fly around the country. She found herself the subject of an investigation by the Secret Service and the Department of Justice into whether or not she was guilty of conspiring to assassinate the president. I'm going to be holding that interview in about 90 minutes' time, so forgive me if I'm a little jittery and running off at the mouth. Can't wait for that. And then Matt Bronger, brilliant American comedian, is my guest tomorrow. All of those will be coming your way soon. I've got a very exciting episode with Chris Addison in the can as well. We've got a solid 2 hours or more with Chris, so the Insiders Club can look forward to some extra content there. And we've got about 15 minutes worth or so, some little extra trimmings from the from this episode with Yahtzee, all available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders for those of you who like to support the podcast and access that private podcast. That's all the stuff for now. I will post ramble at you gently after the conclusion of this conversation with Yahtzee.
So let's talk about Zero Punctuation.
Okay.
Where were you in your life? What were you doing when you released your first one?
Well, when I released my first Zero Punctuation video, I'd been online for quite a few years. I'd been throwing a lot of shit, hoping something would stick. Like video games, the webcomics. I wrote a blog for a while. And, mm-hmm. I was pretty like self-taught in all of that. I trained myself in writing comedy by like forcing myself to update my blog once a day for a year.
Oh, well done. That's not easy.
Yeah, and without just doing like diary entries, trying to like actually write something funny.
Okay. Sort of
comedic essay thing.
Okay, you've kind of created a little open mic circuit for yourself.
Sort of.
In order to get out there, have a bit of commitment to something, forcing you to do it, even when you don't want to, and kind of training up those muscles.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of like archives on my old blog. Early on stuff that makes me cringe a lot, and it's sort of gradually increasing in quality as it goes along.
And the blog is Fully Ramblematic?
That's the one, fullyramblematic.com.
Okay,
and in
the writing of those blog pages. Sorry to interrupt. As we will both have become aware, there is a slight pause on the the internet connection that we're using, or the Zoom.us, which is doing very well, and it's a nice clear sound. But occasionally we are hiccuping over each other's timing, for which I apologise. Just to interrupt briefly, in terms of the blogging, mm-hmm. that's as a means of what made you commit to that system of like, right, I'm going to do this every day for a year?
I think because I didn't have much else to do, frankly. At the time I was living in Australia, I'd moved over there to be with my internet girlfriend. And I was on, like, I was applying for a permanent residence visa based on a de facto marriage because we were living together. And part of the, like, prerequisites was that I wasn't allowed to work. More than a certain amount. So, and before that, I'd been, like, working at a data entry office back in England to save up the money to move. And part of how I coped with that work was just to write stuff in between columns of figures. I did some pretty good writing in my data entry days because you had time to think about what you were going to write.
Yeah, I think that's common to a lot of people with kind of boring, shitty jobs. It can be quite a fecund thing, and you've got something to kick against every day.
That's what after a while, I started seeking out boring data entry temp jobs. So, because I was a fast typer, they were always impressed by how well I could do the data entry, but I could also, like, work on my own stuff in between.
Okay.
Just add a sentence to an essay in between. So
yes.
I'd been doing that for a few years, trying to make a living. And I think zero punctuation first happened after I broke up with my long-term girlfriend that time and was in a very dark place. And I moved in with one of the friends I'd made in Brisbane. And I was in between data entry temp jobs. I think I had permanent residence by then. Yeah, that's right, because I was looking for another job. And somehow I think it was like the burgeoning field of online video at the time. YouTube was around at that point. And I had it in my head that I wanted to do something like that, but I didn't have much professional equipment. I didn't have any webcams or... because this was before I had a smartphone. I think this was before I had a mobile phone. And so I had this idea. I would take this crap headset mic that I bought for like $1 from the dollar store down the road. And I'd make a slideshow of images that I'd put together with the default video making program that came with Windows.
Okay.
And so I did that. I just had... that was the idea, basically. I'd just write down my... like a review, because I'd been doing reviews before then for my own site. I actually did some articles for a video game magazine in Australia before I died on that.
And would they have had the same voice, the same persona?
Oh no, I think video game magazines were on the way out at that point. The internet was destroying everything in its path. I think they were just looking for content to stick between adverts. I don't think they ever even edited the text I sent them.
But what I mean is that the text that you sent them, was that you writing from the same tone with the same sort of aggressive, you know, those qualities that we associate with zero punctuation?
Well, it wasn't aggressive. I was trying to be... I was doing like lighthearted comedy stuff, like what I'd... like some of the stuff I've read online, like I used to read online. It wasn't hard-hitting journalism or anything. It wasn't interviews or previews. It was just stuff that's sort of what clickbait is now. Like, here are five stories of how someone injured themselves with video games. Sort of written in a funny way.
Gotcha.
But I'd always like I've done reviews on my own site of various things.
Mm-hmm.
And because, as I said, I was interested in the field of the funny, angry review. Firstly, from Charlie Brooker, also from Victor Lewis Smith.
Oh, yes. Now, I don't know that much about Victor Lewis Smith. I feel like I've read a lot of Brooker.
Yeah.
And I remember particularly from from TV Go Home and then later from Screen Burn.
Yeah.
And I every time I think of Charlie Brooker, obviously he's gone on to just such enormous things with Black Mirror. But to me, he'll always be the person who wrote the sentence describing Jade Goody's mother, Jackie, as dot cotton reflected in a dented kettle.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the most extraordinary uses of language and kind of visual comedy.
It was certainly
word economy.
I mean, Charlie Brooker's great at analogies, and that's one of the things that was one of my big influences in Zero Punctuation. But Victor Lewis Smith, who did stuff like TV Offal back in the day, and I think Brooker has acknowledged Victor Lewis Smith as an influence. He used to do like TV criticism, but he'd do it in this very sort of fast talking, quick cuts, quick edits kind of way.
Okay.
With the sort of anarchic sense of humor to it.
And I think I've seen your first zero punctuation video. What was the game that you were reviewing?
It was called It was a game called The Darkness.
Yes.
That was the very first one I did.
It's amazing how much of what you do now and have done since is already contained within that.
Well,
like in terms of like you struck out as like this is it's going to be like this and it stayed like that. That worked.
Yeah, I mean, stick with what works. There you go.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, that's just why it took off instantly. I think I knew within like a day that I had a hit on my hands there. Because like the developers of the game I'd talked about, like got in touch. And the escapist, who I eventually started doing the series for, got in touch within a day or two, offering a contract. And that was how it all began, really. Just build a better mousetrap and the world beats a path to your door, I guess.
Yeah. So that's where to begin with this. So, I mean, for people who haven't yet, and I'll say so in the intro of this episode, if you've not seen Zero Punctuation, it's fast-talking, scathing, high-status video reviews, video game reviews. One of the most exciting elements of it for me as a person obsessed with comedy is that there are two tracks. There's the written track and the performed, the verbals, and then the audio stuff. Sorry, the visuals are doing complementary and often different jokes.
Yeah,
and those two tracks are and they're present in that very first video. Not only are you made the decision to cut all of the pauses out. You kind of went through it and removed every time you drew breath.
Well, that's part of it because I hate listening to mouth noises myself, and I can't think how anyone else would want to hear mouth noises.
Is that really where that decision came from? Because I assumed it was something clever about kind of speed and puncture. I mean, it gives you the effect, of course, is that it enables you to. And I think in that very first one, there are three jokes in the first 9 seconds.
I'm going to tell you something that might surprise you, but I never intended to be do it fast.
Okay.
I've put it out and someone said, blimey, you talk fast. And that was never the intention. I just wanted to sort of speak to illustrate the images and cut out the pauses for breath because I thought it sounded weird. But and I think I speak fast because I'm a sort of naturally anxious person, a naturally nervous person.
Yes, are you trying to get it over with?
I guess so. I mean, this is the main difference between what I do and stand-up comedy, is that, as you say, I write the script, I record it, I create a second track with the images, and I think what I'm trying to do is just sort of cram enough jokes into one space, because you don't know, making the video, what's going to go down well. You don't know what the audience is going to laugh at.
Of course.
I'm terrible at like predicting what's going to be like the big takeaway joke that's going to be quoted everywhere.
Okay.
So I'm like forever going to like Wikiquote or some other sites or Reddit, like looking up like the response to the last video and seeing what people are actually quoting from it.
Okay, so so that is very iterative.
Yeah, because of course in stand-up comedy you instantly know if the audience likes the joke, don't you? Because you get a laugh and you can like...
Okay.
You can adjust the jokes from like night to night. But
sure.
I just got like one thing to put out that's up there forever, so I just try to cram as much I can into a small space and hope that enough of the jokes hit, really.
That's fascinating. So the whole time you have been, I mean, I'm going to say secretly, I'm not suggesting you've ever made a secret of it, but that really surprises me, given the status of your persona as the zero punctuation guy. Because, I mean, is it you? Do you feel like it's you? When you're kind of performing it.
There's a lot of me in it. I think I am putting on a character to a certain extent. I mean, the fact that it's a cartoon is that already. But I also get very hyperbolic. I sometimes do like jokes that imply that I might be a murderer.
Yes, or that you live with your mum.
Yeah, which I don't, incidentally.
I believe you.
I try to like affect a persona that's sort of more pathetic and dangerous than I am. And I think that's something that a lot of other people on the internet do. Have you ever seen Red Letter Media's videos?
No, I must have. I must have seen some of them. The name, well, I feel like I can see the logo.
Well, the thing you'd most know would be their hour-long review of Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I've seen a good chunk of that.
Yeah, which they do. And they do a similar thing where they sort of adopt a character and they make the character this incredibly misanthropic, hideous murderer, sort of Buffalo Bill type.
Okay.
And I think that's partly what I do as well. And I think that's partly why it works and why those are effective, because to a certain extent, there is still this sense that it's a little bit pathetic to do in-depth critiques of popular culture.
Okay.
And I think if you distance your narrator from reality to a certain extent, then I think people come with you more than they would someone who's like nakedly being themselves and be giving like being a sort of excessively nerdy.
Yes, I do. I feel like there are lots of people out there doing themselves, saying, "Hey guys, welcome! It's another video." You know, and it's very easy. That's kind of a grey soup, isn't it? There's quite a lot of soupy, similar stuff out there where a nice, upbeat person describes a thing and cracks wise. Do you know what I mean? in a way that doesn't particularly grab me, certainly.
Yeah, but I think it's easy to alienate an audience if you're doing that by not being the sort of person they like.
Yes. Or
not being the sort of person they might sympathise with. But if you're like very deliberately being something that's very other, like a murderer or a cartoon, then people like are more willing to go with you when you go into weird tangents. Like there's bits in those Mr. Plinkett Red Letter Media reviews. There's a bit in one video that I always think of where he talks about how black people don't go and watch Star Wars. And I always think that, you know, I feel like that's the sort of thing that would be picked on a lot in modern outrage culture. Mm-hmm. But I think they get away with it because they're very, very deeply into this character and everyone realizes it's a character. And you can sort of get away with saying slightly more fringe things.
Yes, I think because there is a sense that it invokes the knowledge that, look, we're saying this in inverted commas.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I do try to be honest with the way I criticize games. I do get very hyperbolic, but I wouldn't say a game is good if I thought it was bad or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, the opinions are all kind of genuine. And I see a lot of people, a lot of comments online, usually directed at people who are very angry at something I've said about their favourite game, or whatever.
Sure.
Say things like, you shouldn't take him seriously because he's doing a comedy performance, it's not serious reviews.
Okay.
And there's part of me that feels a little stung by that, you know? Because it is my honest opinions. I do like to think I've got an informed view on the subject by now.
Yeah.
So it's easy to feel I feel a little bit dismissed.
Is that the price you pay for being so funny? You know, you need that license to be funny. You need to be able to say the unsayable, which means...
Yeah. I suppose whatever mental gymnastics the audience has to go through to want to keep watching suits me.
I want to just kind of stay for a moment with this idea of you looking at the comments on Reddit or wherever to see which jokes are most popular.
Yeah.
In order that you can talk to me about how that process has changed the voice of the character over the years.
Well, it certainly made me shy away from getting too out there in like a stream of consciousness.
Oh, okay.
It's important to get the feedback from the audience. Because once you start not caring about what the audience says, you turn into like George Lucas or Tom Cruise or something.
Okay.
So I suppose it's hard to like pick on specific examples, but I think, reading the comments keeps you grounded in a lot of ways. And
do you have a thick enough skin to read negative comments?
I'd like to think so. In practice, not always. I am the kind of person who sort of like will gloss over 100 positive comments and then just dwell on the really negative ones.
Of course. Every comedian I know says don't read the comments. You know, the comments rather. You know, there's so much vitriol out there, which we all take very personally, I suppose, because it's our face and our writing and our thoughts. I mean, it's certainly your voice.
Yeah, and I kind of have to read the comments because, you know, I haven't got the audience feedback that the comedian gets. So it is important to stay grounded that way, as I said. And I think of... At first, I think it very much felt like me when I was doing it first. At first, it was just like me writing my opinions and voicing them. I think the character has definitely evolved over the years. Like, there's, like, I think he has a specific voice that's quite distinct from my own voice.
Okay.
Part of it, like, because it's scripted. But, you know, there's a sort of... Yeah, these days I sort of, like, enter a... mentally enter a mindset as I record the videos.
Yes. Oh, well, talk to me about that. That's right up the street of this podcast.
Well, it's... a lot of it comes from the same sort of things I do when I'm recording audiobooks, because I do that as well.
Yes.
Which I guess we'll get to later, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But when you adopt a character, you have to sort of have a sort of physicality to it as well. So what I do is I sort of like take a particular stance.
Yes, I love it.
I sit in a particular way, sit forward with my like my elbows out. And speak kind of from a specific kind, speak from a specific spot in my mouth, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Because when you like have to voice different characters in an audiobook, that's something I tend to do in that.
Absolutely. Change the way your body is in order to kind of get you into the zone of that character.
Yeah, and because you can hear it. Like, I've heard... Like people who work on like phone hotlines and stuff are often told that the listener can hear when you're smiling, and it's and it's true. You can hear when a person's smiling. I mean, so if I just sort of speak from this particular area, and I can't really do it without the script.
Sure. Okay. Could you? I'd love to hear you switch from your conversational voice to your zero punctuation voice.
Okay. Right.
Can you contact a line from a recent review or a thing to say, just so that we can hear the subtle change? Because I feel like I can identify it, but I'd love to hear it.
Hang on. Let me bring up one of my recent videos. Here's my Resident Evil 2 script. Did you play Resident Evil 2? This is the very recent Resident Evil 2. That's a remake of the original.
Oh, the recent. I have seen the first 20 minutes of the recent one, but I remember the original, and I don't know. It doesn't feel better than the original was to me then.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? So I'll just
this game hasn't made me younger. I'm angry about it. Yeah.
So I'll just read from the second paragraph here.
Sure.
So I was already iffy on the RE2 mate, because the very idea is what we call a mouthful of dinner plate, because it makes me do this.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's turbo. That sounds even faster than I'm used to. Maybe I've been lulled by your conversational voice into this particular rhythm.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, so...
Yeah, again, that's not a skill I deliberately learned. That just sort of happened from nervous energy, I suppose. But I've always been pretty good at reading. I was always a fast reader growing up. I was always impressing my teachers with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I can like read that fast, even from a piece of text I've never seen before.
Oh, I see. Okay, so sight reading.
Yeah.
So how long does it take you to read an audiobook of one of your own? Because we should say, obviously, you've written several novels.
Yes, I am also a novelist. Zero punctuation opening that particular door. That was like the dream when I was very young, because I grew up reading stuff like Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett, and then and then later on like P.G. Woodhouse, because he was Douglas Adams' main influence. And
I didn't know that actually.
Okay. So I always wanted to be a novelist when I was a kid. I tried to write novels when I was a kid, and they were all terrible. But after I started...
Oh, what kind of word length did you get to for a novel as a kid?
Like when I was like... When I was like 8 years old, I'd write something that was... I'm not sure the word length. I don't think my word processor at the time had something that could check the word length, but I printed it out to about 80 pages.
Good God, 80?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Well, I guess I was pretty ambitious as a kid.
What would have been a typical plot or the concern?
Oh, it was just some stupid
8-year-old novel.
Yes, a stupid fantasy plot. Like a couple of guys get transported to a fantasy world, and then like stuff happens.
Did you ever do role play like Dungeons and Dragons or anything like that?
I did that a little bit with my older brother when I was a kid, but I haven't really like followed through on it into my adulthood,
yeah,
like some people do.
Yeah, I did a little bit as a kid as well. I hadn't realised it was going to be such a thing. I should have stuck with it. It's a huge amount of resources available for it now.
I think what it was that I've always like had this... I've always wanted to like imitate the things that had an effect on me. So I read Douglas Adams and wanted to write books. I played video games and wanted to make my own. Even when I was a kid, I was like, before I learned to program, I was like drawing up ideas for video games on my drawing paper and stuff.
Nice.
So yeah, zero punctuation. So getting back on topic, zero punctuation. I got my name out, and I was approached by like Dark Horse Books, and they were saying, "Hey, would you like to write a book about video games?" Because we like, because Dark Horse is usually like comic book publishers, but they were like diversifying into actual textbooks.
Okay.
And so I said, "Do you want to write a book on video games?" And I was like, "No, but I have written a novel fairly recently."
Okay, and that was Mogworld.
That was Mogworld. That was my first book, which is
excellent.
Which has a lot of video game themes running through it.
Yes, that was, well put.
That was what was on my mind at the time.
And so, did you feel? So you had, by the time they asked, you'd already written that book.
Yeah, I mean, I had like a there was a because I'd already finished it because I'd had like a semi chance with the publisher previously, and they'd said, says we might be interested. If you finish this, we might be interested. So I did finish it, but then they weren't interested. But then Dark Horse got in touch and said, "Hey, you know, do you want to write a book about video games? You've already got the name." So I said, publish this book I wrote. And they said, okay.
What sort of speed? How long did it take you to write Mogworld?
That one, on and off, like 2-3 years.
Okay. I mean, I have no frame of reference for how long it takes to write a novel. Well, I'm just wondering if you're dashing off 80 pages at the age of 8, whether you're the sort of writer that can sit down and go, and here's the work, bang, and there it all is.
No. I wonder where all that energy I used to have went. Back when I used to like update the site once a day, well, where did that come from?
Yeah,
but
these days
when I'm writing a book, I sort of stick to a strict one page a day schedule when I'm writing the first draft.
Okay. Do you have any idea whether that's usual? Does that sound...
Well, everyone's got their own way of writing a book, from what I understand. You have to find what works for you, I guess.
And when you're writing, so are you drafting a plot first? I'm sorry, this is my the limit. I'm outside of my my comfort zone as an interviewer now. I'd like to ask you, hopefully not the same old questions about... I'm always... mortified about doing that Alan Partridge style interview of like, what's the fastest car you ever read? What's the slowest car? But so just I read Mogworld,
yeah,
and I'll never forgive you for the ending, but I am about a third of the way through We'll Save the Galaxy for Food.
Yes, that was my third book. I've got a fourth book that's currently... it was released as audiobook first because like Audible wanted to give me more money to license it as an audiobook original.
Gotcha.
So it would be an audiobook first, and the print version is coming out later this year. I don't know when this podcast will go out, but it's coming out April, May this year.
And this is Differently Morphous.
Yes, that's Differently Morphous, which is a sort of Lovecraft meets political correctness.
I mean, that is a strong... that's a strong pitch. I'm really enjoying the title, given that it was Differently Morphous. That's an odd title. And then obviously I read it was about political correctness. So I was like, I love it. You know what I mean? That's like, you could read, it's going to be that sort of a book.
Yeah, and We'll Save the Galaxy for Food, because all my books are like comedy as well, because that's what that's what I enjoy writing. We'll Save the Galaxy was sort of like this satire of big hero science fiction, big boy plots.
Yes, ripping yarn kind of stuff.
Yeah. A space hero who's trying to get through an age like after teleportation is invented and space heroes are not needed anymore.
Yes. And which of your books are you... I'm enjoying it very much. Which of your books are you most happy with?
Well, I'm always going to say the last book I wrote, if you ask me that.
Sure, okay.
Because I feel like if I'm not improving, why the hell do I keep doing it?
Okay.
And I do think, like, my latest one is my strongest. I've written a draft for the next book, actually. I've written a draft for the sequel to We'll Save the Galaxy for Food. And my and my wife's looked at it, and she thinks it's my best, but I guess she has to say that.
Will there be... do you read the comments on reviews of your novels?
Yes, I guess, shamelessly. I mean, that's the sort of paradox of my anxiety, I suppose. I want to hear if people are praising it, but if I see negative comments, then I will torture myself over it. So I want, I want to look, and I do give in and look, and but then I hate myself for it.
And how does it affect you? How do the negative comments affect you? Because you're really putting yourself out there, and obviously I say that as a stand-up comedian, but at least my shows are over. You know, if they go badly, I had one of the worst gigs of my career just before Christmas this year. And I had to get in the car, suffering possibly from actual... I felt like I was almost going into shock, and then had to drive to another gig and do it again 30 miles away.
Oh dear.
And at least it was over.
Yeah. But yeah, but the comments will keep coming forever on
yes.
books and...
So how is that? How is that for someone with anxiety? I mean, is it worth it? Is there some? Do you ever think about whether it's worth it? Like, you obviously benefit enormously from, and you get to express yourself, all of these things. But the trade-off, whereby you have to receive commentary now in a way that, you know, were you a writer 100 years ago, you would never have received it.
Yeah. Well, I do sometimes get into very dark moods after I've looked at like negative comments, and I do have thoughts like, "What's the point? Why am I doing it? Like, if I can't." Maybe I'm just basically not good at it, and if I can't, well, if I'm, that's the case, why bother? But somehow, I don't know, maybe it's the artistic expression that I need to do. Because I do feel like I need to be creating. I feel like I'd go mad if I wasn't.
Yes. Yes, it's interesting. There was a guest on this show, a good friend of mine, Felicity Ward, an Australian comic who was on the show years ago, who talked about picking up Old Faithful and beating herself with it again, you know, just whichever negative thought it was that was the most easily to hand, like, oh, it's this again, I'm feeling like this again, I'm attacking myself in this way again.
Yeah, I'm one of those who, like, thinks about something embarrassing I said or did, like, 5 years ago, and just lets it ruin my mood for the day.
Is there any way out of that? Have you ever tried a way out? I mean, you're in America now. I mean, therapy's common over here. I'm sure now you're in America, it's...
Yeah, therapy's more common, but also healthcare is absolute shit.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, particularly bad now, actually.
Yeah. Do you mind me asking? I'm happy to not ask if you'd rather not talk about it.
No.
But I suffer from anxiety. I've been in and out of various therapists' offices for the last 20 odd years.
No, I'm keen to talk about it. It's a big part of, I guess it's a big part of my motivation and a big part of my life. I guess it's just part of, like, I once saw a self-help book that I've taken nothing from except the title.
And build self-confidence stupid.
No, the title was Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway.
Yes.
I mean, I was anxious about doing this interview. I always get anxious about doing interviews.
I was anxious about doing this interview, not because it was you, but just I get anxious before every single fucking one of them.
I know, right?
I said to my wife before I left the house, I was like, oh, geez, I don't know how much longer I want to keep doing these. That's insane. I love doing them. As soon as they begin, I go, oh, yeah, it's a human. Great, I really like humans.
I know.
But once the build-up...
Exactly. Once I start doing it, I'm fine. I mean, I feel so good once it's done. There's nothing quite so... Nothing that quite makes me feel quite as good as being done with something I was dreading for days.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, for me, this is, I'm 8 hours ahead of you. So I do interviews around 1, 2pm and it's currently 11pm.
Oh, Christ, I'm not keeping you up, am I?
No, not at all. But it's fine, I've got a baby, it's keeping me up anyway. So I've had that, like, all, it's been like a gig in the old days when I first started gigging, and you have the whole day to stew and get nervous about it.
Yeah.
Are there any, besides that idea of feel the fear and do it anyway, are there any other kind of catechisms or anything that you find particularly useful that you can use to care for yourself when you're feeling anxious?
I guess it's just a matter of trying to get outside your own head, you know? Like, if you're feeling bad about something, and one thing I always like doing is playing video games.
And does that help?
Yeah, I mean, I like a video game that really inspires my emotions and my thoughts. But if I want to unwind, then I really like games that you don't really have to think about at all.
Yes.
Like a lot of games where you just grind up enemies for hours and hours. Like sometimes I'll just put like that on, and then I'll like put my headphones on and I'll play a podcast. Or lately I've been listening to a lot of daytime quiz shows that are on YouTube. Like I've been watching Richard Osman's House of Games on. I've been binge listening to that while doing other things.
Okay, and do you find I'm not sure that you rely upon them, but presumably there's a big financial incentive to continue doing the zero punctuation.
Well, yeah, that is certainly a big incentive. But part of the anxiety, I guess, is not wanting to disappoint people.
Yes.
So
yes, sure.
When I'm obligated to do something for a contract, the worst thing in the world would be to not fulfil my obligations.
Okay. That's interesting. I wonder why that is.
Might be.
Do you have a sense of why that is?
Well, might be because I need a strong father figure. I don't know.
Okay, are you being glib, or is that actually one of the?
Well, I'm partly serious. I didn't really get on with my dad, and I'm not really in touch with my family at the moment. And okay. So I sort of, there are various people I've latched onto as pseudo father figures over the years. And when I started doing zero punctuation, okay, I was very naive. And but everyone I've done work for, I've sort of been very anxious about disappointing.
Okay. And now you're doing work for everyone on the internet.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound so healthy.
Well, I was thinking about advice I would give to people who wanted to, like be successful on the internet doing YouTube videos. And I think being high quality is one thing, but the equally important thing is just being consistent, you know? Just putting out, like, as I've done, a video every week without fail on the dot, 9 o'clock every Wednesday. If you do that long enough, you just become part of people's lives, just become part of the background noise. Yes. And maybe they don't think about you, but they watch you every week and they'd miss you if you were gone. And I think there are a lot of people who take a lot of comfort in what I do. I mean, we recently put out a video on YouTube, which we put out because someone else had made one like it and they were stealing our copyright material, so we had to put a stop to it. But it was a weirdly popular video, and it was just all my zero punctuation videos back to back with the title and end music cut off. So it was just like 4 hours of me talking in a constant stream. And that's been a weirdly popular video. We made our own one of those, and everyone was like, "Finally, this is back!" Like, I'm just going to sit back and like go to sleep listening to this.
So that's what the other person had done. That's what the offender had done, and so you did it.
Yeah. I mean, there was clearly demand for it. We saw how many views it had.
Okay, the people just wanted to listen to an unbroken stream of zero punctuation consciousness.
The weird thing is, I've listened to it myself, and yeah, there's something strangely hypnotic about it that makes it hard to.
Yeah, you do speak with a particular rhythm, don't you? And I imagine that rhythm would have some sort of drumming, trance-like quality.
I think that, yeah, it's one of the first things that someone said to me after I first put like a recording of my voice online. They said my voice was very smooth.
Okay.
And my audiobooks do really well, probably better than the print version.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's
why I suppose. Yes, okay, sorry.
That's why, well, I don't know if they sell more, but they certainly make me more money, partly because I record them myself, so I take the paycheck for that as well.
Yes, that's very smart, yes. And then bookended by music that you've written yourself that's only two notes. That's the secret. That's the, you need to, I'm sure someone has done something like that in the past. I'm sure I've heard stories about comics who are like, oh yeah, you've also, was it Chris Moyles, the breakfast DJ in the UK? He's briefly a radio, well, not briefly, for a good while, he was a Radio 1 breakfast DJ. And I think they played these constant idents, which were just daft little three or four note ditties. And yeah. I remember hearing, oh, yeah, he does that deliberately so as to... I mean, this is all hearsay. I can't attest to any of this. But I believe the theory was that he did that deliberately because then that becomes a copyright piece of music that he also gets paid for. Smart.
Oh, clever.
Yeah. Hello, Audible.
I see a lot of comments on like reviews of my audiobooks saying things. I was worried because it said... like the author was reading it rather than a professional reader, but I was pleasantly surprised by the sound of the voice.
There is something about your... obviously, your voice is a huge part of your practice with the zero punctuation videos.
Yeah, people recognise me in public from when they hear my voice. They very rarely...
I was going to ask that, yes.
They very rarely recognise me from my face. They once recognised me from my dog. Because I do like video game streams as part of my work... like to have some kind of interaction with the fan base, you know?
Yeah.
So I do like a couple of those a week. And the one I do on Wednesday, I just point the webcam at my dog the whole time. And a while back, I was like walking my dog around the apartment complex I currently live. And someone else who was walking their dog sort of stopped me and said, "Are you Yahtzee?" And they said they recognized my dog. They recognized my dog from the stream.
That's extraordinary. I was going to ask you, I feel like you have I'm interested in the level of fame you have, because you do seem to, like, unlike most, I would think most YouTubers, if you would consider yourself a YouTuber, most content creators online have their faces in it, so yes. They are instantly recognisable. That's part of it, it's a kind of a bid for fame, I imagine, from the outside. But you have that kind of quality. I remember there's a TV show I was doing some warm-up for, a chat show, and the artist Sia was in the building. Mm. And, of course, she never... I mean, very occasionally, you know, she doesn't perform with her face visible. So she has this incredibly, this extraordinarily recognisable voice and apparently writes everyone else's pop songs as well. Mm. But she gets to hang out in the cafe with her crew and the lighting guys and the band without being hassled by anyone ever. And you just think, oh, God, you don't have to pay that particular price of fame.
Yeah, not usually. I mean, there are some, like, super fans.
Okay.
Because the face is online in some places.
Sure.
But it does happen if people hear my voice. And then. It used to happen more often, not so much these days. I think I'm past the, like, explosive part of the fame, of the viral fame thing. I've settled into the nice, comfortable groove stage.
What does it cost you?
What does it cost me? Financially?
I don't mean financially. I mean, what has it cost you? It's clearly, you know, the benefits are fantastic. You've millions and millions of downloads. It's opened all these doors for you. In the same way that, for example, stand-up comedy, it's exhilarating. It's wonderful. I'm living my dreams. I'm really showing those kids that no longer exist that I went to school with, you know. But there are hugely exciting, positive things about it. It's also, it can be very isolating. There's a lot of really tedious travel involved. You know, it has that kind of gilded cage quality. Are there similar things in what you do?
Well, there are things I've noticed. Like, occasionally I take, like, contract gigs back in the day. One time I took a gig writing dialogue for a local game company on top of doing zero punctuation. And what I found was that I really relished the opportunity to go into an office and actually work alongside other people at a desk where I could just turn around and talk to another person.
Yeah.
I suppose. And another thing is, I used to post on internet forums more.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big internet forum called Something Awful that's been running for it's got to be over 20 years now, maybe.
Okay.
That's a fairly popular forum. And I used to be quite active on there. But when I was still active on there when I first started doing zero punctuation, but it soon became clear that I could no longer post anything without instantly diverting the attention, like diverting the topic to talking about my videos.
Without other people then talking about it, you mean?
Yeah, and I guess I kind of like. I guess yeah, that was when I felt a sense of isolation. From doing it, I no longer felt part of that community.
That's interesting. That's almost like that's almost analogous to the fact that you don't need to put up with certain aspects of fame in real life.
Yeah, it's the at the side of the seesaw, I suppose.
Yeah. That's very strange. And did you rely upon that community?
Well, it wasn't like a regular part of my day, like browsing the forums.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it was like I was totally emotionally dependent or anything, but I certainly missed it when I wasn't involved in it anymore.
Are you happy?
Yes. I think if you'd asked me that a few years back, I might have a more complex question, but last year I got married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And we're talking about getting a new house, we got a dog. And I'm happy now in a way I probably wasn't through a lot of the years when I lived by myself, doing like turning out zero punctuation every week.
Okay.
It feels good to have someone around who understands my life and what I need to do for it. And she is. She's very understanding.
So that was Ben Yahtzee-Croshaw. Thank you so much to him for coming along. And thank you as well, Nathan Wood, who has gone above and beyond this time to stitch together two disparate sound files recorded remotely. I think this is the first episode we've ever recorded remotely. There are elements, it was the only way I was going to be able to interview Yahtzee. And elements of it were, it's very exciting to think that I can be talking to people all around the world. Elements of it were tougher because it's much harder to utilise those pregnant pauses I'm very fond of and, you know, potential silences to encourage my guests to speak more when you are at the other end of an internet connection. And eventually, if you do pause for long enough, one of you will say, are you still there? So that's a little bit tricky. And we were dealing, as you may have gathered, with a little bit of a delay in the connection there. So I am pleased that we had such a fruitful conversation. And thanks again to Rob Smouten for the music and to Peter Dobbing, podcast consultant. And thank you to all of you for listening to the show, for supporting it, for tweeting it, sharing it, subscribing. Important to subscribe, of course, so you get all the new content. And those of you who have gone to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to sign up for all the extra stuff. That's all for now. Will I have a little post-amble? I feel like I've got lots of exciting stuff to say about South by Southwest, but I will wait and talk to you about all those exciting things on the end of a forthcoming episode that is from here. That would make more sense, wouldn't it? But I'm having so much fun, and I'm riding a little motorised scooter all around the place, and it's just the best thing ever. I don't know if I could bear to get one in the UK, but here everyone's on them, and it's so great, guys. I'm in the future. I'm in the actual future. Thanks all for now. That'll do me. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will speak to you next week. Bye for now.